home of the stars, through the airwaves and on the big screen. Live from Hollywood, it's Rated LGBT Radio with your hosts, Garrett Miller and Rob Watson.
Good evening, good evening. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio, and I am Rob Watson. Always a thank you to Garrett Miller, who is executive producer of the show and the platform, and to Brody Levesque for providing a lot of the topic work and background there in getting this thing produced. We also have some renowned panelists, including Brody Levesque and Dawn Ennis, who I'm thrilled we had Dawn on as a guest, and we have now corralled her as a regular journalist panelist. And tonight we have a very special guest that will be coming on. I've had the pleasure of both interacting and interviewing and writing about Kathy Baldock for years now. And we have her in our scope, and we are going to pick her brain, experience, and wisdom on this topic, and I can't wait. So we're going to get to the topic right away. And I want to address it from my perspective, from a little bit of a personal one. I grew up as a good Christian boy, raised in a Methodist church, went to Bible school, loved the church, loved what I was learning, loved so much of the principles that I was being taught as a Christian. And in those olden days, there was a phrase of being a good Christian, and nobody scoffed when you said that phrase. There were principles based on Jesus's ministry, and they were generally seen as admirable. And not only that, there were organizations that were starting very important humanitarian initiatives around the fact that they were coming from Christians. Fast forward to the marriage equality and LGBT movement, and there Christianity became very adamant, or factions of the Christian movement became very adamant against what was happening with the gay movement and the LGBT and the transgender movement and the lesbian movement, bisexual movement. There, I could understand it in terms of quote-unquote Christian principles, because one of the cores of Christian principles was to be self-sacrificing and not look at yourself and your pleasures or your even your talents. It was all about sacrifice and being selfless. And so some of the things that were coming through on human sexuality and human gender expression seemed to be counter to that. And that humanism seemed to be counter to that philosophy. They didn't really, because for me and for a lot of us who argued against that, the principles were pretty clear that Christianity and this broader sense of what it took to be human and the benefits of being human and appreciating the humanity in each other were also in Christian principles, particularly the second commandment that Christ gave, which was to love one's neighbor as oneself. That implied equality, humanity, and understanding. And that carried through a lot of Christian principles, although a lot of other people focused on a more rigid self-sacrifice and lack of sexuality, which was also in the Bible and was there. But there were debates about its prominence, et cetera, et cetera. Flash forward to today, where the Republican Party and the people in it who claim to be Christians are embracing things that you can't even find in the Bible. These aren't Christian principles. These are their own hatreds, their own pleasures, their own desires masked in what they're calling Christianity, which has nothing to do with Christian principles. And so for me, part of the topic tonight is this complete decline in the Christian philosophy from where it started to where it is being bastardized by these groups and these people. And with that, I'm going to, first of all, I want to bring on Kathy and our regular panel. And I want to start with Kathy. Good evening, Kathy.
Hey, how are you doing? Thanks for having me back
I'm
on.
Great.
It's been a while, huh?
I know, long time no talk. We've got to, you know, we need to meet more often, but we need to do it not just over microphones.
Yeah, I chit chat with Brody all the time. So Brody, whenever anything is going on in the Christian world, Brody calls up, and it usually starts with a string of three or four expletives, and then followed by the word Christian. I say, oh, what did they do?
Well,
those
yeah,
phone calls have been coming a lot in the last 2 years.
Yes, yeah, we seem to be on the same party line. So, yeah, Brody, we got your number, definitely.
Yeah, don't we? Sorry, Brody.
Yeah.
No, it's all right. Yeah, I deserve that.
Well, and I gave kind of, I identified myself up front as a Christian, and a lot of my writing has been addressing Christians specifically and Christians behaving badly. Whatever I've done, mm-hmm. Kathy, you've done on steroids. I mean, you have been
yeah.
in the face of the worst of the worst. You've been stalked. You've
mm-hmm.
been bullied, badgered. I mean, you have carried the cross. You know, in terms of being in the face of the onslaught of that. And I do want to mention Dawn, since we got a chuckle out of Brody. Dawn, I want to welcome you to the show. And what is your perspective on the Christian movement, et cetera, and your identification?
Man created God in his own image. That's my basic perspective. But I will tell you a little bit about my own background really quickly. I was baptized, Roman Catholic, raised to be a Roman Catholic, an altar boy when I was presenting as a boy, and I dated a lot of Jewish girls, and I ended up marrying one, and despite the fact that I'm still Roman Catholic, I am raising our three children Jewish. I am a member of a synagogue for the last 14 years. And it's so progressive that they named their transgender Catholic member the chairwoman of the Adult Learning Committee. So that's
mm-hmm.
basically my perspective. I'm active in my church as well, but I can tell you right now that as a transgender woman, I never received the wonderful welcome and the incredible support in my church that I receive every day from my congregation, Beth Israel in West Hartford, Connecticut. I'm very pleased to be raising Jewish kids because I think that they have a phrase that means a lot to me. It's called Tikkun Olam, to rebuild the world. And it's funny how my Catholic faith is mostly focused on telling people they're going to go to hell. And I wish they would take another page from the Jewish people.
I want to say something to that.
It's just really interesting that I was raised Roman Catholic too in New York City in an Irish Catholic neighborhood. So yeah, I got the full force of it. And
hey, neighbor.
I think the reason that the Jews are doing better with these issues in their congregations are because they didn't hook up with politics like the most extreme of the Christians did. So in the late 70s, when the Christians hooked up with politicians, that's when everything started to change. I mean, before that, Christians were sort of the way you described at the opening, Rob, right? I mean, they were known for doing the good things, for having hospitals, for having the outreaches, for having camps for children. That's what Christians were known for. But the problem, the poison, came when they got in bed with politics. You know,
absolutely.
And if you know history, in the 30s, religion got in bed with corporate America coming out of the Depression, and they wanted to get Americans to think about, you know, earning money again and to run away from socialism. So corporate America, big corporations got in bed with religion, didn't work so well. They figured that out in the 50s, but then they did the same thing. I mean, it's like the most extreme of Christians have been whoring themselves to somebody, and every time they do that, they lose the focus of what the message is, what the mission is, what the beauty of faith is, whether it's Catholic, whether it's, I mean, there's beautiful things to the evangelical faith too, Methodists, the Jewish faith, all of these things, there's beautiful pieces to them, but not when you bastardize them with politics. We're seeing what happens.
Which, ironically, in the scriptures, that's kind of addressed not to do that, which is, I mean, I think you're kind of following exactly what I was saying. It's like, it's sort of there, like that's, you know, selling out for politics is kind of a theme that Jesus went after, and
right. And
we're seeing kind of his counsel coming true. Brody, I think you had a comment.
Well, to tie this together from what Kathy has just stated and what you've been talking about, what Donna said, Religious Right radio host and American Family Association spokesperson Sandy Rios defended Republican Alabama Senate candidate Roy Moore on a broadcast early today on her show. And she basically begged the Alabama voters not to let the quote-unquote ick factor of the allegations against Judge Moore prevent them from voting for him. And then one of the things that, you know, she added to that is that, and this has been kind of the overarching theme in the last couple of weeks, particularly in this particular issue with the religious right and Judge Moore in particular, is that they literally will take an epiphilic behavior out of a judge who's also violated separation of church and state over the Democrats. I mean, that's how badly polarized it's gotten. Rios also said on her show that Moore is hated because, quote, he has stood so strongly for the Ten Commandments and marriage between one man and one woman. And, you know, she went on. Ladies and gentlemen, please, I'm begging you, really, especially those of you in Alabama, not to stay home. Do not let the ick factor set in, because that's what the establishment in Washington wants, she said. Further, she said, they want to cast enough paint on Judge Moore, and it will be someone else next time. Trust me. And of course, that plays to the theme that, you know, they're constantly harping on, and Kathy can go in a lot more detail in that, but that's the persecution victim theme that they seem to run. Bob?
Right.
And the funny thing Brody, was when you said she's asking people to not buy into the ick factor, and that's exactly the factor they pushed on the whole same-sex marriage, LGBTQ equality, right? It was like, ick. We're gonna
right.
be motivated by the ick factor. But now when it's to her disadvantage, we don't want to be motivated by the ick factor. We're actually supposed to ignore it. Consistency would be a fine thing.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. Two things, because since you brought up Sandy Rios, Sandy Rios is an interesting character in the religious right. She, because I did some research on her before when she came out with something that was off, and pardon my French, but she's old. She's like much mm-hmm. older than she appears. And in her mm-hmm. past, much of her life was spent in this wonderful way. She was a mom. She had a daughter who had a disability. Her daughter passed away. It was very tragic, which normally when somebody goes through that, it sort of hones them into this sort of superhuman, having gone through that experience. And she went a completely different way. You know, blonded up, plastic surgery done,
right.
you know, became
right.
the spokesperson type thing. But, and this is the point that I kind of want to use with her. On her blog, she had a piece that she wrote. It wasn't necessarily about politics, but it was about the crucifixion. And her take on the crucifixion was centered completely on Mary losing a son. That was her whole perspective of what that was about, which is an interesting perspective, except that it had it was completely devoid of what was really happening there from a religious standpoint. And so my point is, she is very characteristic of somebody who takes the verbiage of the Bible and wraps it and twists it and kicks it to the curb when it's not her agenda, her very personal agenda. So the deciding on what's an ick factor to vote for because of, and what's an ick factor to ignore, is completely characteristic of her MO in the past. The one other comment I wanted to make, and Don, this is actually to you, just from a spiritual standpoint, one thing that I always found very inspiring from a transgender standpoint is that in the very beginning of the Bible, it actually isn't just that man is created in God's image. It was God created man and woman, created he them. And it's written in a passage that it almost defines that transgender nature of both God and humans. And it, where it's not defining us in buckets, but these qualities that, you know, could exist in a spectrum. So, I mean, I think there's inspiration there that is very consistent. And Don, I think you had a question for Kathy.
Well, I do, and I'll just respond quickly to what you just said. I've had a lifetime full of people quoting the Bible at me at why I can't be who I am, or why I don't really exist and I'm really just a gay man, or lots of other things that the Bible says. But what really boggles my mind, as someone who went to Catholic school from first grade all the way to 12th grade, as someone who still practices as a Catholic, that Roy Moore and his supporters seem obsessed with what the Christians call the Old Testament, what Jews call the Torah. The fact is, they completely seem to ignore the New Testament, which teaches us, Matthew, go to the room inside your home where only my Father will see you praying. Don't stand on the street corner. Mm-hmm. Don't stand up in the synagogue. Look to remove the plank from your own eye before you notice the speck in your brother's. Love thy neighbor as yourself. All of these things that my Jewish friends remind me are Christian teachings don't seem to really register with the Old Testament Bible-thumping, quote Leviticus, preachers and specifically Roy Moore and his followers. I'm amazed. What kind of alternate universe do we live in which someone who did what Roy Moore is accused of doing is ignored, is washed away? And I read one supporter said this, and this is the one that really threw me. Well, you know, as a Christian, I have to take him at his word because he asked for forgiveness. And because he asked for forgiveness, I have to forgive him. No, he didn't. He didn't ask for forgiveness. He denies it. Okay, how do I make sense of this?
Well, I think what happens in the evangelical world, so I left the Catholic faith at the age of 15, and not because of anything I would have held against it, but at the time, so I'm 61, so that places me in history to know that when I grew up in an Irish Catholic neighborhood, and when my mother got divorced, when we were 2, 4, and 6, my mother got divorced, father committed adultery, and my mother was excommunicated. And within an Irish Catholic community, that was huge in the 60s. That was the sin. And so so when they excommunicated my mother, I had a sense of, like, what is that about? So when I could, I walked away from the faith. And then when I had children of my own, I walked back towards faith. So I my entry point, though, was now the evangelical church. And so I was very involved in it. I mean, I even homeschooled my children. I started ministries at my church. I taught Bible studies at my church. And I can tell you that the average person sitting in the pew thinks the things they're doing are loving. They first defer to what they believe the truth of God is, and they would even say that they're going to hold that truth above all other things, even relationship, that they really believe they're being holding an integrous relationship with God by honoring the truth. But the truth that they're following is interpretations of scriptures, difficult scriptures, that pastors have told them, and we've just believed it. And I know, so I came into Christianity at the height of the religious right was involved. But what was more important that was happening was feminism had happened in the culture, right? It happened in the late 80s and the 70s, and by the time feminism hit the church, it was the early 80s. Feminism looked very threatening to the church because the Christian faith, most faiths based on the Bible, I don't think the Jewish faith is anywhere near this, but they're patriarchal. So they're gender hierarchies and they're patriarchal. And so the patriarchy, men in control, could see that when feminism hit the church, they had a term for it. They called it biblical feminism. Well, that scared the crap out of them. And they knew they couldn't say, oh, but we still believe in biblical, we still believe in patriarchy. So they came up with a new word, and they called it complementarianism. So that's what hit the church when I came in the 80s. And it was incredibly strong, and it was this way of teaching women who they were supposed to be. So there was biblical womanhood, there was biblical manhood, and it was a huge movement. And the movement was to keep women in check. And not long after that, when gays started wanting access to faith or marriage, and that came because of the AIDS crisis, families, gay men wanted to form families, lesbians wanted to form families for other reasons. Well, that started to threaten the church in a new way. So they said, okay, it's not that we need to have sex differences. You know, there has to be men and women. Now we need gender and anatomical differences. So they used these principles. They rolled them out on women, and then they rolled them out on the gay community. And whenever you see dogma used against LGBT people, you can bet that it's already been tried on women, and that they're absolutely wrapped around each other, and they're wrapped around each other to ensure that the Christian faith preserves patriarchy, which means strong gender differences. So it comes down to patriarchy in the end, and that is being challenged. And so it feels really uncomfortable to certain kinds of people that they can't do whatever they want to do with their bodies and two women's bodies and control trans bodies and LGBT bodies. It's all about keeping the hierarchy. I know it's a long explanation, but it's about patriarchy at the core.
No, I think that's fascinating, and I would take the principles of what you just talked about and put that mirror up the Trump campaign and his success.
Yep.
And his embrace, because there's almost nothing about Donald Trump that you could go to the New Testament and go, oh yeah, there he is. In fact, if you go to the New Testament to find a person that looks like Donald Trump, it looks like the exact person Jesus said would never get into heaven. That would, you know, it's easier for an eye to or a camel to go through than an eye of a needle than for someone like Donald Trump to go to heaven. But yet he's been embraced. And what you just said actually makes some sense of that. There's anybody who represented the patriarchy more, it is
mm-hmm.
Donald Trump.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep.
Kathy,
yep.
I wanted to ask you something that I think you've come across probably as much as I have, probably more, pardon the expression, the more comment.
More with 1-0.
But more with 1-0, right. The thing that I have run across over the years of people who are arguing for these sort of bastardized Christian principles, who claim that they take the word of God. If it's in the Bible, they believe it. Every one of those people I've ever come across has said, actually, you have to be lying, otherwise you would be a really horrible person. Because to Don's point, if you live completely by the Old Testament, they have awful things in the Old Testament. I mean, they have
right.
directions
right.
to rape and pillage. They have justification for rape against women, going back to your idea of the patriarchy. But I mean, it's the directives in the Old Testament would not make good people at all. It'd make pretty horrible people. And the New Testament is a complete departure from that in so many ways.
Right.
What do you ascribe to that disconnect of somebody who truly, I mean, they truly do not take every word of that the Bible says literally, but thinks they do? How does that schism happen?
Well, I have a personal belief that it's almost to me like Genesis is just beautiful poetry. Genesis is ancient people looking in the sky, looking at one another and saying, how did we get here? Who is God and how did we get here? How do we interact with nature? How do we interact with the seed we put in the ground? How do we interact with the animals and the people? And they tell their story of how that happened. Do I believe that God breathed that story into their ears? I don't. Because even when whoever wrote Genesis, the Yahwist, Christians like to say it's Moses, it wasn't Moses, there's many authors, whoever wrote that down, at the time it was written down, the people of Israel, the people of God, were not even monotheists at the time. And so they were polytheists, and they were going to be polytheists for several more centuries. And so were they listening to God, and what God were they listening to? I think they were just trying to come up with a way of telling their story. So there's no historical proof for most of Genesis. These are just people's stories. But then the next progression I see is, yes, God does come into their life. The God of the Jews comes into their life, but they don't quite get it. And so my proof is exactly what you're saying, Rod, are they listening? And I think it was Don at the beginning that says, you know, religion is our, you know, we make it into what we want to see God as. I have a struggle believing that God would say, see that town over there? I want you to go take that town, but I want you to kill all the men. I want you to kill all the women that have had children because they belong to somebody else, Old Testament law. I want you to kill all the children that belong to another man, another woman, because that's somebody else's progeny. But I want you to take the young virgins. I want you to take the women, and I want you to preserve them. So kill those 20,000. Keep the 4,000 young virgins for yourself and keep all the spoils. That doesn't sound like something God would say. That's what man would want God to say. So I think that people got it really messed up, that God was probably trying to talk to them, was trying to talk to them. And he said, you're not getting it. You're not hearing me. I think I'm going to send something and let him live amongst you to let you see exactly how you're supposed to behave. And so he sends Jesus. Jesus comes along for whatever you see him as, a good man, a prophet, son of God, however you see. He was a great example. But within 250, 300 years, certainly by Constantine, people were off track already. So people started making religion into their own message again and using these wonderful words, these wonderful examples to their own end. And really, that got the craziest it got. I mean, Christians didn't have a mandate to follow the inerrant word of God exactly what it says until 1895. First person comes along and says, this is the literal word of God. We have to follow everything that it says. So that's 2 millennia that had gone by, essentially, with certainly the New Testament, much of the Old Testament, where people didn't pay attention to every single word, literally. And then starting in the 20s, that fundamentalism came back. So it's really people that have done this, people that have done it to their own ends, people that have done it for their own power, other people using people to do it for their own power. But I don't think what's happening, what we see, is God at all. I don't think this is the example of Jesus. This is definitely man taking what he wants words and examples to be and to use it to their own advantage.
Very good. Brody, you have a question?
Well, I think looking at it, and Kathy, you and I have had this conversation several times, and Don, you and I have had this conversation, and Rob and I have gone back and forth on it, and it's all about agenda. Earlier this afternoon, anti-abortion activist Janet Porter had a press conference in Birmingham for Judge Moore, and some of the people that were included in the grouping of pastors and quote-unquote spiritual leaders behind the judge during his press conference included anti-abortion extremists like Flip Benham and Operation Save America.
Oh, my goodness.
Thomas.
Yeah.
Then you have people like Alan Keyes, Gordon Klingelschmidt, the way out there, discerning of the spirit, whatever. And, of course, Porter herself. And then you also had Steve Fultz, who was a major fundamentalist Texas activist and a funder of Actual Moore's campaign. But one of the things that was a constant, and the only standout to that, Don, you might note this one, was Rabbi Nelson Leder. And, of course, Rabbi Leder is always denouncing the abomination of marriage equality and homosexualism.
Yep.
Yeah, well, he was there, too. But the thing is they kept, Judge Moore himself, but Porter and these other people so much were, just banging away, that we need this person to stand up to, transgender mafia, which legislates sins, that the Bible brands, as an abomination into public policy and, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And they're running on the life team and everything else. It just seems to me that they are so heavily invested in Matt Staver, the head of Liberty Counsel, defended Moore on MSNBC earlier today using the same theme. They're so heavily invested in their interpretation and their vision of the Bible. Kathy, I don't see them backing off at all. I mean, it gets to the point where they're actually delivering their own message of persecution themselves. But at what point does the public say, wait, this is getting crazy? I mean, is Judge Moore really going to be the benchmark in craziness for the Christian right? I mean, the guy's accused of the sexual molestation of women and a 14-year-old child.
Well, I don't see that group backing off. This is kind of blunt, but I see them dying, dying out, because they're not going to let go. I mean, we all know that there are a young crop, I call them frat boys, coming up out of Heritage and Ethics and Religious Liberties that are just as bad. But what I see happening that is going to change their lives is they're kind of all in that age group where they're all having children. And they're going to be having gay and trans kids. And their kids are going to be bringing home their friends that are gay and trans. People will be challenged to change. But these older people, they don't know it any other way. They don't know any other comfort. I don't see Judge Moore having a come to Jesus or come to anything kind of meeting. I don't see Porter doing that. I don't see Rios doing that. LaBarbara, I don't see any of those people changing their ways. I just see them dying. And because young people of faith are not tolerating this anymore, and I'm not saying all either, but they have friends that are gay. They are gay. They are trans. They do look around them and see that white, heterosexual, cisgender men are not the ones that should be, interpreting the Bible and saying what's right and wrong. And even today, I was listening to something on NPR, and they were talking about federal judgeships. And it was just astounding how many white men Trump is putting into these positions still. And Brody, we've had this conversation that if he does this, it's not just going to last through his term. These people get lifetime appointments. And they'll be sitting within the Beltway making their rules for the next 40 years. And that's frightening, too. But so they're going to die off. Young Christians are very hip to this. I think one of the biggest challenges within conservative communities is LGBT people coming out, and unlike 5 years plus ago, their parents are now sticking with them overwhelmingly compared to before. And so once you get the parents on board in these congregations, because they're in every congregation, in every denomination, in every state, you wake those parents up and they're going to start causing hell in the church and challenging, and they are. So they're going to change things, but likelihood is they're going to go to more progressive churches and just let these people from the Southern Baptists, Ethics and Religious Liberties, they're just, you know, I think they're just going to spin and they're going to lose their power. I mean, when you read The Death of White Christian America, that book last year by Robert George, I'm getting the name wrong, from PRRI, he says that even by 2024, there's not going to be enough white Christian people, even if every single one of them voted, to put someone in office like they did Trump this time. So this is, they're gonna white knuckle this thing to the end, but numbers, it's just going to be a numbers game. People die. Oh, well.
Wow. Don, I think you had a question.
Well, don't let the door hit you on the ass on the way out is what I want to say to that.
Yeah, as you fall into that big hole in the ground. So sad. Too bad, so sad.
I would like to just make one point, and then I want to ask a question of Kathy, reflecting on something she said earlier. First is, in the early part of 2015, prior to the marriage equality decision, I was the news editor, the Advocate, and I wrote a very large, well-researched piece that basically raised the question of the downside of marriage equality, and my particular assignment in that theme was that trans people are going to become the next boogeyman, that after marriage becomes something that is now enshrined in law, that all those conservatives are going to need to find someone else to hate, and it's come true by and large. The thing that really makes me wonder, though, Kathy, and I wanted to just ask you about this. You mentioned before the patriarchy. What would happen if Roy Moore had had relations with boys or with young men? I mean, isn't that sort of like the line that it's okay that he's, you know, piddling around with young girls, but if he were to be same sex, he'd be done so fast his head would spin.
It'd be over. It would be over. Yeah, it would be over. Because that's not just a man taking what he's supposed to. That's a man not acting like a man. Because it's, it matters very much what's on the other end of that penis. If the other end of that penis is a female, yeah, that's okay. It doesn't matter the conditions it's under, as long as the on the other end of the penis is a female, but if on the
She's
other end of
woman.
The penis is male, then it's a problem, right? That's a problem.
It's a shame.
I'm seeing, people weren't so much talking about the blueprint of human sexuality in Genesis, even when we were doing marriage equality, but boy, once trans people started coming out of the closet or coming onto their radar, boy, all of a sudden Genesis 1 is all the rage, which is why I keep talking about Genesis 1, about it not being a scientific book, not even logically being from God himself. It was people looking back. I mean, archaeology, anthropology tell us that, you know, the most fundamental view says that Adam and Eve was 6,000 years ago. Well, that can't even be possible. It can't be possible. So when you try to say to people, well, this is what Genesis is about, and that's their entire linchpin for discrimination against trans people. It used to be, I'm sure you're familiar with it, Deuteronomy 22:5, a man shouldn't dress as a woman, a woman shouldn't dress as a man. That has nothing to do with people dressing up in each other's clothes. It's about a man shouldn't dress up as a woman and go into the tent of women and hide out in the tent of women for two purposes. So that when everybody is going off to war, that man is sitting in the women's tent, not going off to war. And the second, you know, these are the rabbis. The rabbis don't know exactly what it means, but either that or a man shouldn't dress up as a woman and go into the tent of women with the intent of taking another man's woman or for adultery or for fornication. So that verse went by the side, and now we are sitting camping on Genesis 1 as if, you know, we're going to take these verses written from an ancient culture 6,000 years ago, written down 2,600 years after the event by people that have been playing telephone for 3,400 years, passing down this exact scientific blueprint, and we're gonna take that as the truth instead of looking at the people in front of us and saying, tell me your story, listening to the scientists, listening to therapists, listening to psychologists, and saying, can you explain this? Can we just kind of talk about this and explain it with the people right in front of us and hear them? Or are we going to take this illogical, non-scientific blueprint? And Christians, fundamentalists, have fallen to the side where they're going to say, we're going to hold with a death grip onto what it says in Genesis 1. And if you don't follow male or female, you're out. You're out.
But intersex people,
that's a product of the fall.
Exactly.
And as I say to people sometimes, I say, so where is this list of what's a product of the fall and not? Where's the good, bad list? Because after the fall, that's also when children arrived. So are children bad too? Because they don't show up until Genesis 2, which is after the fall. So you can't play it all the way. You can't say, well, some things are good and some things are bad after the fall, but I get to say what's good and bad. And LGBTQ people are bad, and in particular, T people, there's like nothing worse.
Yeah, no,
yep, that's me. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, Kathy, I want to ask, is while you were talking, and I really appreciate your pointing out the through line of the patriarchy and how people have used the Bible, it sort of occurred to me that there's a similar issue with the core of a lot of these proponents that is an issue that happened in the last election, which is that there is a part of the population, and I realize they're not the whole of either group, but a predominant part of each of those groups are the uneducated, are the mm-hmm. ones that, you know, want it simple. And so many of the Christians that fall into what you've described are the ones that I think of that use the Bible as a spell book. You know, it's like they trot it out, they open a page, and boom, they pull out their magic mm-hmm. spell to throw against something that's convenient to mm-hmm. them. And it's kind of consistent with what the theme we had tonight. But a lot of what you talked about earlier is how I see in my studies of the Bible are very much in parallel with, in terms of taking it as a whole, taking it as this combined document that is actually both historically and aesthetically fascinating. Like the fact that Genesis is, if you really look at the document, it cannot be one document. It has to have come from multiple documents. The very first chapter and the second chapter overlap in their themes, and they don't really agree with each other. Even to the Gospels, they talk about the same events and give different facts for the different events. So there's virtually no way for somebody who's reading it with any kind of critical thinking isn't putting together the context, the history, the, you know, sources of these documents and everything else. And if you do, it doesn't mean that you don't have to have, you have to be completely atheistic. It just means that you see the development of a spiritual path that isn't tied to this ridiculous idea that you have to take it literally, because if you put it together, you virtually can't take it literally. So that's my long-winded question to you in terms of, is just biblical education another route to dissolve this ignorance?
So are you saying a more accurate education of what the Bible is?
Yeah. Accurate, but even reading it in, because there's some things, and this has driven me crazy over the years. For example, Romans 1, which has been used in recent years to beat up gay people severely, if you read Romans 1 through Romans 2, because the document originally was not annotated,
right.
So there really wasn't this cutoff at the end of Romans 1. Romans 2, the very beginning, starts saying you can't judge the people in the previous passages, number one. Number two, the context, if you read the through line, these are people who rejected God. Whatever they do, they reject God first, and then they have these behaviors which are orgiastic, heterosexual, and then they bring in kind of same-sex stuff implied in that. And if you take it in context, it's very hard to really throw that up and say, oh, that just means you shouldn't be gay. But it's
no.
not. It's not.
The problem with people doing that to Romans 1 is they're completely ignoring not only context, but also, okay, so if you're talking to the Jews or the Gentiles, if you're talking to the Romans or the Greeks and the Jews at the time, what would they have been thinking of when you told those stories from Romans 1? When you say, since the beginning of the world, what would they have been thinking of? And we're not taught as evangelical Christians the context of what they're thinking of, but they've been what the people of that time would have thought about is Paul was saying to them, hey, remember in the beginning the stories we've told ourselves of how evil entered the world, how sexual perversion entered the world. Let's talk about those things. We're going to talk about those things, and those things are here. And the very odd thing is both Paul and the Stoics, the Greeks he was talking to, all had the opinion that any kind of sexual passion was wrong. So what he's talking about is sexual passion being wrong. And the context he even says it in is heterosexual sex within marriage attached to passion, Paul saw as wrong. And so when I bring that up to people, I say, hey, he's not, you know, so if you're saying as the pastor, ha, 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 hubba, hubba, you know, I can have sex because I've got this hot wife with always dyed blonde hair sitting there who's producing children for me. That's rather harsh, but I can enjoy sex with her because it's within the confines of marriage. If you want to follow the Bible, that's not what Paul's saying at all. He's saying, don't do that within marriage. You've got to completely look at context. And people are not taught the context of these stories and what he's really talking about. You can't stand in 2,000 years after these texts are written, impose your 21st century sensibilities and understandings on ancient texts and say this is what they meant. That's ridiculous, but that's what we've done. That's what we've done.
No,
and we've done it
yeah, exactly.
to control people.
Yeah, exactly. And your point is so well taken and exactly what our topic tonight in terms of there's a heterosexism that has embraced heterosexuality as being holy when the Bible doesn't make that holy either. It's like, that's still monkey.
No,
that's still, you don't
no,
get
there
that.
Were, there
fun.
Were periods
no.
of history where the right thing to do was to remain unmarried. There were hundreds of years within the Catholic Church where the right thing to do was to remain unmarried. And when you did have sex, it had to be procreative, right? So anybody that's heterosexual that's doing one of those other varieties of sex that is not procreative, that is technically within all of history, you know, certainly when the laws were passed in 1533 against sodomy, that was sodomy. Even sex within a heterosexual marriage that was not procreative, that was sodomy too. But, you know, we heterosexuals, we can't be guilty of sin. So sin is, a great definition of sin might be, sin is the other stuff, the stuff other people do that we don't do.
That's exactly it.
You know?
Brody, you had a question. Jump on in.
One of the things that I've worried about over an extended period of time since I've been covering particularly trans issues, they've weaponized Christianity. It's a weapon. At what point does mom, pop, apple pie, Chevrolet, and Walmart customer get that it is a weapon. And my next part of the question is what is it going to take to de-escalate or de-weaponize, you know, the faith? Because as it is now, this is what they use. It's a political weapon. It's a cultural weapon. You know, it goes after people like my friend Don. It goes after people that believe in women's reproductive rights. It's just, at what point do we get it scaled back? And my number one complaint hasn't been necessarily the small fringe, such as the folks we were talking about that participated in that conference tonight. And as you've so accurately stated, they're never going to back off. I guess it's how do we get not all Christians, which is my least favorite expression, to understand that we need some sort of de-escalation or de-weaponization? I mean, where do we go from here, Kathy?
Well, I honestly think that the people in the pews see this going on, and they say, that's not the way I behave. So there's two lines progressively moving up. We've got the religious right fundamentalists, very conservative Bible readers that are intensifying their grip. But at the same time, the culture is changing. You know, people sitting in the church pews, sitting in their chairs and in their robes, they are not living a life out of the culture. They have kids. They have grandchildren that are coming out. Their kids are bringing people home. The other people in the church are looking at this and they're saying, but wait a minute, that lovely gay couple that just moved next door that have adopted 3 unwanted children, oh my God, they're the best parents I've seen in forever, and they sure do love each other. So as the fundamentalists are doing their death grip, the culture, Christians are in the culture, and they are seeing what's happening around them. And they don't want to be identified with those white-knuckling Christians. Some of them do, but they're not educated. But what's changing people is it's not just LGBT people coming out. It's life crisis that operates with outside the spectrum of Christianity, like good Christians don't do. Whatever good Christians don't do, when that happens in their life, kid gets pregnant, son has an opioid addiction, someone gets thrown in jail, someone has a tragic problem with alcohol, kid comes out, real life things happen to disrupt their Christian don't do list, and then they have to reevaluate their faith, because typically things that Christians don't do are not well received within churches. So you start getting ostracized. Christians don't get divorced. In a lot of places, if a person gets divorced, you might as well just leave your church because you're going to get stigmatized or ostracized. Not every church. But when crises, so people coming out, real-life crises happening in people's lives, and the faith is focused on all these other things rather than taking care of people, people are going to not be interested in those kind of churches anymore. People are going to go to churches where they say, oh, you know that church on the other side of town? They are really gracious people. I hear they have a woman on staff. I hear that there's parents of gay people meeting together monthly talking about it. People hear that stuff, Brody. They really hear that stuff, and people shift. So, you know, you can't say, because I'm a Christian. I identify as a Christian, and I'm an activist because of my faith. So I'm not like the rest of them. Yeah, I mean, we don't like that not all Christians saying, but my faith is what motivates me. My faith is what keeps me going when people are after to me and telling me I'm not a Christian and I shouldn't be doing what I'm doing. I keep going because I'm not going to let these people hijack and identify and tell the story of what a Christian should be. Because they've got it wrong. They've got it wrong. Yeah.
Fair enough. Fair
Amen.
Enough.
I am so in that boat. I just have to jump in on that. They piss me off more because I'm a Christian than because I'm gay. Absolutely. Don, you had a question?
Well, I wanted to ask, America is the land of numbers. You know, we're number one. The people who do all these surveys say that there's 1.4 million people like me who are out in America. And a lot of surveys lately, Kathy, have said that there are more nones, N-O-N-E, people who don't believe in any religion than there are even Christians. I want to know, Kathy, do you know how many of these people are out there? I mean, what are we up against? What are the numbers of these evangelicals, these Roy Moore type people?
Well, you know, and it's going to be geographic, right? So it's going to be very much in the South, but it's also going to be in conservative congregations that are all over the place. They are not growing them. They're not growing in numbers. And when they say they're growing in numbers, the way they're typically growing in numbers is because immigrants or other nationalities are joining their churches. So Hispanic population, there's a lot of conservative Christians among the Hispanic population. Asian Pacific Islanders, oh my goodness, huge number of born-again evangelical Christians amongst those. But they're not growing, and the nuns are growing. The nuns are definitely growing, and they're growing out of the younger people. I've heard the number. I don't have any proof of it, but I've heard enough people say it that they're impressed with their own numbers, that when 5% of the youth that have grown up in their church stay within their church and grow within their church and then create their own families and stay, they're impressed with 5% retention rate.
Wow.
Like, wow. Wow.
Wow.
And something you said before, Ron, I wanted to comment on about how we've accepted and normalized, Christians have accepted and normalized Trump. A study just came out again from PRRI just this week, and it said, in 2013, tell us how much it bothers you that can your political leaders lead accurately? Would you vote for them if they had moral issues within their background? Divorce, adultery, you know, whatever moral failings that we aren't supposed to have are in our background, would you trust them within office? So they asked people in 2013, and then they asked them in 2016. The people that have given the largest leeway to say, you know, that's not so important anymore, the largest increase of turning a blind eye to moral failings has been within this white evangelical community.
Wow.
The
unbelievable.
Every other group. It's right? But these are the ones that said, you know, Gary Wright, what was his name, who had Donna Rice on his boat, Monkey Business. Gary, what's his name? Come on, Brody.
Gary Hart
had her on his lap. There's no way he could leave. Absolutely no way. Remember, we had that, I mean, Christians have that stance, like, any moral failing, you cannot be in any kind of political office. And now the numbers show,
guys,
we are the most, we have turned our eyes and said, yeah, we know they do that, but we still think they can be good leaders.
Guys, we're down to our last literally 60 seconds. Yeah, we're down to our last 60 seconds. Kathy, thank you so much. Dawn, you've been a pleasure joining. Brody, I know you had one quickly sound out on what's been going on tonight.
Yeah, I wanted to give Brody a shout out to the Matthew Shepard Foundation. They kicked off their 20th anniversary year at the Stonewall Inn in New York City, and our good friend Julia Scotti performed along with our friends from the Shepard Foundation, Dennis and Judy Shepard, and of course Sarah Wilson, their director of communications. So congratulations. I hope you guys had a good time at Stonewall. Don, as always, it's good to be on with you. Kathy, thank you so much for coming on. Rob, back to you.
Amen.
Amen. Thank you.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio. We'll be here again next Thursday. Also listen to Out in Santa Cruz on www.ksco.com on Saturdays at 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 10 p.m. Eastern. And we will talk to you then.